promoting meaningful conversations that cross the racial divide. One news story after another is triggering conversations about race and racism in America. Most of these stories are from other places in the U.S. Think Charlottesville, Virginia. But this week, Maine had one of its own when Jackman's town manager posted online remarks about, quote, white civil rights and creating a place called New Albion, then denied being a racist. Many townspeople expressed outrage, and town selectmen fired him. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on Maine Calling, we'll discuss racism and how to talk about it with two women who have thought a lot about racial divisions. In fact, they're leading a series of workshops in Maine titled Tell Me the Truth, Exploring Cross-Racial Conversations. Shay Stewart-Booley writes the Black Girl in Maine blog. Debbie Irving is the author of Waking Up White. Maine Calling is next, but first this news. From the Maine Public Radio studios, I'm Jennifer Rooks, and this is Maine Calling. Martin Luther King Jr. wrote, 300 years of humiliation, abuse, and deprivation cannot be expected to find voice in a whisper. In today's media landscape, people who were once voiceless or struggled to be heard can get their message out, especially on social media. But talking about race remains difficult. Today, we're going to hear from two women about their effort to help others have conversations about race and racism and bridging the divide. Joining me in the studio, Shay Stewart-Booley. She is the creative force behind the blog Black Girl in Maine. She's also executive director of Community Change Incorporated, the oldest continuously running anti-racist organization in the United States. Debbie Irving is the author of Waking Up White and is a racial justice educator and writer. Together, they're holding a series of workshops they call Tell Me the Truth, Exploring Cross-Racial Conversations. Visit our website or Facebook page for more information on those. There are a few coming up. As always, though, we want to hear from you. How often do you talk with people from another race? Do you talk about racism? Do you have a friend or family member who you find to be racist, but you don't know how to talk with them? Our phone number, 1-800-399-3566. You can send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to the Maine Calling Facebook page. Welcome to you both. And what I'd like to start with is your stories, how this became each of your mission, and then how you found each other and decided to do this. Shay, start.
I would say for me that this work actually was very accidental. I moved to Maine in 2002 from Chicago, and I found Maine to be a really white place. And I really struggled with it, and I needed something to sort of do, a vehicle to sort of like just kind of put this all in. So I started writing about race. And over the years, the writing sort of grew. I wrote for the Portland Phoenix for a number of years, wrote for other publications. 2008, I started a blog. And from there, it just sort of took off. In 2013, I interviewed for a position in Boston. My current position is Executive Director of Community Change, Inc., and sort of brought together all these pieces of my life. And I should mention, I have an undergraduate degree in African American Studies, as well as a master's in management. So it wasn't really accidental. It just sort of all came together. But it wasn't really my life plan. As far as sort of connecting with Debbie, one of the first things that happened when I actually took over as executive director in 2014 was that Debbie reached out to me. Her book had just come out, and she wanted to do an event in Cambridge, and I agreed to do it, read her book. We sort of connected. Friendship sort of formed from there. And these sorts of dialogues that we now do sort of accidentally happened. And really, it was just because we had a connection where we discovered that despite our age and our just sort of racial and socioeconomic differences, we were really able to talk at a level that rarely happens across racial lines, even in racial justice communities.
And your version of the story, and Debbie, and also how you came to be someone whose passion was talking about racism, confronting it, and helping others have that conversation.
I would say, like Shay, for me, it was completely accidental. I don't think many people working as racial justice educators, anti-racist, grow up thinking it's what they're going to do. So something pressures or positions someone to do that. And for me, I was a nonprofit. I grew up in a white suburb and then went to an all-white college, predominantly white college, and ended up in Boston in the nonprofit world, and then in Cambridge, Massachusetts as a classroom teacher. And in both contexts, I found myself with this uncontrollable urge to want to help, as it turns out, help fix Black and brown students. So I was working trying to connect arts programs to school, after-school programs in the city of Boston. And then just in the context of my classroom, I was noticing always that it was the Black and brown students who had a particular struggle that I couldn't quite reach. And there was so much tension all around me in these initiatives, and especially whenever there was an attempt to have a conversation about what was going on that made the lives of white people in Boston and Cambridge and Black and brown people in Boston and Cambridge, what was so different? And I couldn't talk about it. I had this overwhelming physiological response, this fear that gripped me that I was going to say something stupid, something to embarrass myself, something that would expose my ignorance. And it was so fearful that it actually stopped me from even really being able to think about it.
Mm-hmm.
And if you don't talk or think about something, you develop zero knowledge about it. And also, if you're so afraid of conflict, which I was, you develop zero conflict navigation skills. So the reason I'm so passionate about this is the lid just has to come off the ignorance about what race and racism is in this country. And it's also important that every human being develop emotional resilience and the ability to have difficult conversations regardless of the topic. And we are really dumbed down as white people in many cases in this country by being told that there are taboo topics that then just keep us quiet.
It's interesting that you said you were afraid of having your ignorance exposed, because part of me thought I was afraid I might say something that would hurt somebody's feelings or be insensitive. But you didn't say that.
That was true, too. But actually, I might have said from my conscious mind I was afraid of hurting someone's feelings. But the deeper truth is that if I say something that hurts Shay's feelings, she might let me know about it. And if she lets me know about it, then there's conflict. And I don't know how to resolve that. So over time, I've come to understand that I was actually less afraid about hurting someone's feelings than having to navigate the fallout from saying something offensive.
You said the lid needs to be blown off. And one of my questions for you, I was going to ask this a little later, but I'll ask it now, is do you think that our times, our president, have blown the lid off of this conversation in a way that wasn't happening before?
Oh, absolutely. I think the past, few months now, has really forced a lot of white Americans to see some things that they have never wanted to see. Prior to Trump being elected, I mean, we still had the series of, you know, Black and brown people being killed. But even then, people didn't want to see certain things because you could always sort of go, well, maybe if he had done this or he had done that, the police wouldn't have done what they did. But in this current moment, we are seeing behavior that is so blatant and so egregious, and it's really making people think, wow, maybe I don't understand what racism is. Which I think for many white Americans is really something that they struggle with. I think that people see racism still as it's a guy, you know, with white sheets, it's a cross on the yard, it's using the N-word, it's using racial slurs, and don't really understand that they are like based in this system that ultimately, unless you're made aware of the system, you are a willing participant in this system that oppresses other people from a racial perspective. And I'm happy to let kind of Debbie take the white side of that question.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So the word system would have completely, it did baffle me for the longest time. What system? What system? It's a level playing field. So what's, I think, really important is to contextualize the United States of America. And I'm going to have to use a word that is a triggering word for many people. But white supremacy is a term that we all need to understand and learn to use. When I use the word white supremacy, I am not talking about the KKK. I'm talking about a philosophy. It's a philosophy that came to the United States of America originally with colonial settlers from Europe and eventually got embedded into policy with the construction of the United States government. And it's a philosophy that says white people are supreme, meaning superior. And if a certain group of people are superior, of course, if that's the thinking, of course that's the people to be in charge. Of course that's the people to have access to rights, resources, representation, and to respect. Of course, The thing is, first of all, it's not just white people who are superior. It's white, it's male, it's Anglo, it's Protestant, it's able-bodied, it's heterosexual, and it's
well, promoted by the bogus eugenics movement of a century ago.
And one more thing, it's elite. It's owning class. So, yeah, so the eugenic movement came both, and this is the way it works, it both grew out of that group of people wanting to prove their biological superiority, and because they were the ones spinning the narrative, it ended up being used to spin the narrative. So white supremacy is the context that we are living in. And what I find so interesting about Donald Trump is that he's pushing every single button simultaneously. He's showing racial bigotry. He's showing sexism. He's showing adultism. Well, I'm not quite sure how he's showing that. I'm seeing that much more like in the Larry Nassar case. He's showing homophobism. He's showing religious intolerance. All of these ways that people have been marginalized and vilified by the white power structure for centuries, some ways more subtle than not, are happening right now in a very not subtle way.
I want to ask you all about what happened this week in Maine, in Jackman, Maine. We booked this show a long time ago. We've been working really hard to find a time when you can both be here together in Portland, Maine, in our studio. And yet this happens this very same week. Shay, were you surprised by what unfolded?
Not really. And I should add that I was actually out of town. I was in Chicago, so I had only been hearing bits and pieces coming up on notifications on my phone. And so I started following what was going on. But then when I saw the whole story about the town manager being hired, and it turns out, you know, he's got this dream of, you know, creating his white supremacist utopia. No, I'm not surprised at all. I think actually on the Black Girl in Maine Facebook page, I actually pointed out that, you know, the inability of most people to talk about race, white people specifically, really created a space for, you know, this guy to kind of go up there, because nobody really would have been asking any questions if he had not been just sort of putting it out there on social media in such a way that people had to pay attention to it. So, no, I'm totally not surprised. I know that some of the comments, you know, on Saturday and Sunday online, there were people in Jackman saying, you know, they had no idea. He seemed like a really nice, polite guy, but they really had never talked a lot with him. And I thought, this is exactly the, you know, reason why I do the work that I do, especially with Debbie, to get people to probe a little bit further. I mean, what brought he's a fairly young man. What brought him to Northern Maine without having that connection? What sort of was he envisioning up there? And I figured nobody probably thought to ask those questions to kind of get a sense of what he was about. I mean, I actually looked at some of the stuff he posted online, and it seems to me he was pretty open about his viewpoints in terms of seeing white people as the superior race.
It's interesting to me because he said, "I am not a racist." And which made me think, and we hear this is just the most recent. I mean, a lot of people in the public eye who've been in these news stories, that's part of what they say. I am not a racist. What is a racist? How do you define a racism? How do you define racism?
Well, I think that for me, I tend to use the definition of power plus privilege, and I look at who holds power, who holds privilege, and who has the ability to affect other people's lives with that power and privilege. And historically, when we look at it, and even in this current moment, when we look at it from that definition, it is white people who hold that power and privilege. Yes, there are individual people of color who have access to power and privilege, but as a collective, they don't hold power and privilege. And I think that one of the things that makes the conversation around what is and what isn't a racist so hard to define is that we use a very simplistic viewpoint. The man was espousing supremacist racist views. He is a racist. And I'm going to just say right now that one of the things that troubles me in this conversation is that the media is complicit in allowing these people to not have to answer that question. You know, only recently, I think it was really until the moment where Trump referred to several countries as being blank holes, that the media really wasn't pushing up against him. I mean, he couldn't have gotten much clearer with that, saying these countries are this way. Why don't we get people from Norway, one of the whitest countries on the face of the earth? We're too polite to sort of push that button to go, no, if all of your views are saying you want to live in a white separatist state, I think we're on to something there. And even then, we sometimes play the, Oh, the other side game. Well, you know, black and brown people, they want to live a certain way. Well, it's not the same thing. It's not the same thing at all when you look at the history of the fact that black and brown people were put in certain spaces. We weren't allowed to have access. We weren't allowed to have our own, you know, to go to schools with white people. So thus we've created historically black, you know, colleges and universities. So it feels like even when we try to have the conversation, it's dishonest at times because, again, no one wants to say, you know what, I am a racist. And it's interesting because in racial justice spaces, and I'm sure Debbie, you know, would be happy to talk a little bit about that. For white people who do the work that we do, there's a certain point where you have to reckon with the fact, you know what? I am a racist. I am born in this system, and it may not be my intention, but that I've absorbed that piece of the culture and that I have to be really intentional in fighting against it. Otherwise, every day when I go outside, my default setting says I'm a white person. That is what's normal. Anything else is not normal. And I fall back into that, thus perpetuating racism.
Mm-hmm. You know, and I would expand it to say, you know, I have had to wrestle with my internalized ideas about white superiority, but I would expand it. I was exposed to all the white supremacist ideals. So I've had to grapple with, isn't Protestantism, why isn't that kind of the better? That was my religion. I have classist ideology. I got over my homophobia early because I was working in the dance world and I had a lot of cross-racial friends. That's the thing, is that friendships really go a long way to changing the way we understand some of the garbage that we've been fed as being garbage. So for instance, the way this can still show up with me, race is a particularly stubborn embedded idea in many people's imaginations and certainly mine. The higher the stakes are, the more I see this showing up. So if I need a surgeon, I really kind of want a white man. If I have to go to court I feel and be defended by a lawyer, I feel more comfortable with a white man because I was so conditioned from such an early age to believe that that really was the most fit for leadership, the most competent, the smartest kind of human being on the planet. So, the guy up in northern Maine may be a racist, but I'm a little bit of a racist too.
Was it hard for you to come to terms with that, to realize that about yourself and to actually say it out loud to other people?
It was horrifying. And that's the whole point of my project, is that I find that when people read my book, they finish it and they put it down and they are dying to talk to someone else about what they're starting to understand about their own socialization.
Okay.
Yes.
Now, what about the idea that a racist is someone who makes assumptions about someone else based on the color of their skin? Is that just naive and old-fashioned?
That's someone who's prejudiced, and anyone can be prejudiced. We do. The root of prejudice is to prejudge. And yes, we all prejudge to some degree. And to some degree, it's not necessarily a bad thing. I'm thinking that as a woman in this current climate, there are most certainly times that I should prejudge a situation, and I hate to do that, but it's, you know, often about safety. But yes, that sort of definition that you just used as someone being a racist isn't really applicable to me, because anyone can be prejudiced, but to be a racist is different. I hope I answered that for you.
All right. Well, the whole reason you're here and the whole reason you're on this series of events and with, as I mentioned, a few coming up in Maine, is you want other people to have conversations. How do you start the conversation? How do you examine your own beliefs and talk with others about them without being afraid of exposing yourself, being afraid of hurting someone's feelings, being afraid of saying something wrong?
I think for me, I'm not really afraid to hurt anyone's feelings, and I don't mean that as a negative. I mean, I'm not responsible for how you receive information. I am only responsible for my intention, which if my intention is to not hurt your feelings, if you receive it in that way, you are not happy with how you received it, you need to deal with that. That said, we're very clear that when we start these conversations, we use ourselves actually as the example. We talk about conversations that we had very early on in our relationship that honestly, I think that for many black and white women in this country, given that white women themselves hold a certain level of power, would have been the end of the conversation. And yet, for some reason, I didn't make it the end of the conversation. It became, hey, I really didn't like what you did, and I want to talk to you about that. And that's really how we tend to open up, talking about the things that we grapple with, and then inviting our audience in to talk about the things that they need help with. I can tell you this much, that having done this work just alone in Maine, it is not uncommon for me to, you know, go to a community and find out they're grappling with something in their schools, or there's a local issue and nobody knows how to talk about it. And for me, it's, let's put it out here, let's start parsing it down, and then looking at, here's some ways that you can handle this yourself. How you can learn to sort of get over the fear, the trepidation that you're going to say the wrong thing or that you're going to hurt someone's feelings, because ultimately silence is being complicit. And we know that there are things going on that are wrong. We need to speak up.
Well, Debbie, I want to hear what you have to say, but we're 2 minutes late to the break. So we're going to take our break. And when we come back, we'll continue this conversation and we'll have your comments and questions. This is Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
You make Maine Calling possible. As does Maine Seacoast Mission, empowering youth, promoting health, and supporting Down East and Island communities since 1905. More at seacoastmission.org.
How does the immigration enforcement system look to one family caught in the middle of it?
I'm gonna cut my hair when my dad gets out of there.
We're a country of laws.
This is the American dream, you know?
I'm Ari Shapiro. We've spent months following one man's journey through immigration detention and trial. We'll tell you how his story turned out this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
All Things Considered is weekday afternoons from 4 to 6:30 here on Maine Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, how the leadership of the Trump administration's Department of Health and Human Services came to be largely composed of anti-abortion and anti-LGBTQ activists, and how that's affecting policy. We talk with Dan Diamond, who covers HHS for Politico. Join us.
Join us for Fresh Air tonight at 7 o'clock, right here on Maine Public Radio.
This is Maine Calling. I'm Jennifer Rooks. Today on the program, talking about race, with me in the studio, Shay Stewart Booley, the person behind the Black Girl in Maine blog. She's also executive director of Community Change Incorporated. Debbie Irving is the author of Waking Up White, a racial justice educator and writer. We invite you to join the conversation. Call 1-800-399-3566. Send a brief email to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. Before we go to the audience questions, I want to say to you, Debbie, that I know one of the things you talk about is that one of the things you were indoctrinated was to be nice. So it's hard to have these conversations when you're always trying to be nice.
Yeah, the question is, who gets to decide what nice is? If I think nice is not talking about race and just being colorblind, that's not going to work out very well for my friend Shay over here, because it's really important that nice for you, I don't know, what would nice be for you?
Nice for me is like just putting that elephant on the table and naming it. In fact, I really struggle when people are nice and don't want to talk about race or make assumptions because, well, I didn't want to ask because I'm trying to be nice. No, let's not be nice. And I think it's interesting that as a Black woman, I'm not conditioned to necessarily be nice. I'm not conditioned to be angry, but I'm definitely not conditioned to be nice, because from my perspective, nice has no value. But I think from a white female perspective in particular, yeah, there's a lot of value for you being nice.
Mm-hmm. I get rewarded for it.
Right. You get rewarded. Mm-hmm. I get run over if I'm nice.
Right. So, you know, whatever group is in power gets to define what's good, what's bad, what's nice, what's not nice, what's too angry. And so I think it's really important in this work. We're really questioning a lot of that. I value truth. That is the thing I hold most dear in my life. So when in conversation, if Shay says to me, you know, something you did really landed badly on me, Debbie, I could try to defend myself, which would alienate us from one another. Or I could say, wow, this hurts, but I want to hear your truth. So that's an example of how it shows up in friendships.
Let's start with a Facebook post. This is Diego. He writes, with respect to your conversation today, may I see that what needs to be fully understood is that the term is meaningless in the context of the human species. We are one. Skin tone and hair texture does not make a difference in our mental, physical, or any other attributes.
Well, in an ideal, perfect world, that would be true. But we don't live in that world right now. We live in a world where 12-year-old boys playing on a playground are killed. We live in a world where 18-year-old young men are perceived as demons and shot because of the color of their skin. So we need to have these conversations. These conversations are critical because right now we're not at that place. And it's one of those things that when someone says to me, we're just a member of the human family, honestly, that's coming from a place of privilege. That's not coming from the place of someone who has to worry about when they walk in the store, will they be followed around? When they get behind the wheel of a car and they're stopped by the cops, will they be shot and killed? So, yeah, I guess that's what I have to say to that.
And I would tie it to Dr. King's, you know, he did say he had this dream that one day we would all judge each other by the content of our character, not the color of our skin. So no doubt it's an aspiration, but we are so far from that. And you can look at the other end of the spectrum when you say, oh, we're all just the same. There is no other combination of identities that could be doing in the White House what Donald Trump is doing. There is no black man. There is no Chicano woman. There is no transgender person or even a bisexual or homosexual person who could occupy the office of the president of the United States and get away with the stuff he's getting away with and not have it attributed to the basic flaw embedded in stereotypes around that identity.
Let me ask you, though. I mean, basically, Diego has said, is what I've taught my children. There is no, we are all human beings. So your children, you teach your children this, but then they go out into a world where, have I sheltered my children by telling them everyone has equal value?
Let me ask you this question, Jennifer. How many close friends do you have of different races that your children see you interact with in your house, having breaking bread together, going to their houses?
Well, I live in Maine, so there's okay. Your answer.
Okay, fair enough, because if you had those relationships with people of difference, and maybe you had to hear that, you know, when I don't know how old your children are, that often the way we raise our children racially is very different because we have to prepare our children for certain truths. I think that would then start to affect how you are shaping the world for your children.
You know, if Diego said of equal value, that everyone is of equal value, all a member of the human family, that I agree with. What I don't where it starts to break down is that no matter hair color, eye shape, or skin tone, we are all having the same experience because we're not. We're not having the same experience. And for people in privileged positions like me, I've got class privilege, racial privilege, heterosexual privilege, Christian privilege, the burden is on me, I believe, to start to understand the ways in which the world isn't working for people who don't benefit from those privileged identities in the way I do. So I am all on board for that vision and that aspiration, but we will never get there if we don't start by owning where we are now.
Kat on Facebook writes, just wanted to comment that I was born and raised in Jackman, identify as transgender, and am shocked by the level of outrage by the townsfolk. I wish it were that balanced and tolerant when I were growing up.
I think I would say thank you for sharing that. I don't know what else I have to say to that, because I think there's like so much to unpack in that as someone who lives in Jackman and can really speak to those experiences of what it has to be like in a town like that.
And, you know, that comment, thank you for that comment. And it really, for me, just drives home the extent to which a town, a community can feel normal, quote unquote, normal to a group of people and crushingly marginalizing potentially for other people who don't fit into that normal. You know, we have a myth in this country that it's a level playing field, that we're all individuals. And so it's very possible to say, hey, I'm going to do what I want. I'm an individual. I'm going to start an all-white town and a white utopia, and this is a good place to do that. That can feel normal and all right for people. That's because white supremacy is so normalized in the fabric of the United States that it's invisible to some.
Mary Ann posted on Facebook, what exactly does racism look like? I don't think I'm a racist, but how do I know I'm not just in denial?
I'm going to actually ask Debbie, because this is one of those times, given the nature of our working together, that I think that Debbie can really speak to that as a white woman, because I know Debbie has done some of that internal work of really like kind of examining past behaviors and that she thought was really nice and realizing, holy cow, I think I was not being really nice. So go ahead, Debbie.
So I think, you know, I don't like labels. So instead of thinking, am I racist, can you change the question to, was I racialized? Meaning, was I socialized around ideology along racial lines? And the question is, how much do you understand about the construction of the United States, your country, from a multiple perspective lens? So do you understand what the indigenous history is, the African-American history? Do you know about Black Wall Street, which was an unbelievable, talk about someone wanting to create a racially segregated utopia. There was an incredible, in Tulsa, Oklahoma, a neighborhood called Black Wall Street, which was bombed into extinction on Memorial Day, 1921. Very few people know about it. It was until 9/11 considered the number one act of domestic terrorism on U.S. soil. So if you are racialized in a white bubble, you probably don't know about Black Wall Street, and that's just 0.0001% of the missing information.
I was also going to add, just thinking about redlining, I know Debbie and I had mentioned that, and just thinking about, it's no accident that many of us live where we live when we look at the history of how the government played a role in sort of creating these racialized spaces for us to sort of to live in. So really thinking about, when you ask yourself that question, am I a racist? Well, am I even aware of all of this? I know that one of the things that I hear often from people who read my blog, which is really just personal reflections, and now that I have other writers also sharing their personal reflections as people of color, that one of the things is that white people often don't see these things. And I think that's important to think about. What have I not been exposed to as a white person that has kept me blind? W.E.B. Du Bois spoke of black people living in a state of duality. And it's true that for people of color, we often live with two minds. There's the white world that we're forced to live in, and then there's our own culture. But white people never have to really, for the most part, think about someone else's existence, because whiteness is that normalized, even down to how people speak. You know, we judge people based off how they're speaking. Are they speaking in a way that's not appropriate white English that we find acceptable? And really sort of, I think, examining the things that we've held to be true because someone told us, and generally speaking, a white person told us.
And I would say the entire purpose of my book is for white people to read it, listen to my story, and at the end of every chapter, there's a question for them to reflect on themselves. And I've met very few people who've come out of the book without having a new understanding about what it means to be a white person in America. And it's a perfect pairing with Shay's Black Girl in Maine blog, because I'm telling my white everyday story, and she's telling a black everyday story.
We'll go to Shirley, who's calling from Chesterville. Hi, Shirley. Go ahead.
Hi, thank you. Well, I think this is a good time for me to come in, because I just wanted to ask if you would say more about how we benefit from the system if we're white. You know, even if we personally have the most inclusive, non-racist ideas and ideals, if we're white, there are ways that we get ahead that we're not even aware of. And, for example, I grew up in the South in an area that was designated a federal poverty area, but still there were ways that allowed me to get ahead simply because I was white. And I read Debbie's book, and the point that just really blew it open for me was her chapter about the GI Bill, because I know that, you know, a lot of success that I've had in my life has been because my dad got the GI Bill, and just learning how unavailable it was to a lot of black military men coming out of the service was really an eye-opener for me. So I just wondered if you might say more about that.
Talk about, so the idea of the GI Bill. My father was in the Navy in World War II. I was born in 1960, so I was surrounded by men who had fought in World War II, and white men who had fought in World War II and had come home and made use of the GI Bill, which was a set of benefits to returning veterans. That my father went to Harvard Law School for free on that bill, and my parents bought their first home in Winchester, Massachusetts for $17,000 on that bill. I assume that bill would be available to all returning veterans, but it wasn't. It excluded the 1.2 million black GIs, who I have never seen in textbooks or movies, by the way, and the indigenous GIs and the Latino GIs and the Asian GIs, who were all Americans over there fighting. And the GI Bill didn't say in it that it was a white-only bill, but there were so many barriers already built into our society that they were almost to a person unable to make use of the bill. So we don't have enough time here to talk about what happened on the education front. But on the housing front, the United States housing system had been set up according to redlined maps developed by the Federal Housing Authority in the 1930s. And those redlined maps designated neighborhoods along racial lines and then doled out and advised private banks to provide loans at differential lending rates based on neighborhood, which means based on skin color. So the GI Bill was only good in white-only neighborhoods. So black, brown, and by the way, that $17,000 house my parents sell 40 years later for, they trade up and then they sell that house for $1 million. So when you look at the black-white wealth gap today in the United States, a huge piece of it is what happened around the GI Bill in the 1900s.
Shirley, thanks so much for your call. We do have to take another quick break, but before we do so, a word about tomorrow's program. We're going to be talking about obesity. We will learn how prevalent it is in Maine, what the latest research reveals, and what can be done to manage or reduce it. Email your comments or questions to talk@mainepublic.org, tweet at Maine Calling, or post to our Facebook page. You're listening to Maine Calling. We'll be right back.
We've heard the Me Too movement loud and clear. Now, how do we transform awareness into meaningful change? Join WNYC for a national conversation where we explore how to ignite workplace culture shifts, punishments that fit the crimes, and greater responsibility from men. Beyond Me Too, women, men, power, and change.
You can hear that special program coming up in about 20 minutes at 2 o'clock after Maine Calling here on Maine Public Radio. Well, if you've ever wondered what the Maine Public app does, it allows you to take Maine Public Radio and Maine Public Classical with you on the go for mobile streaming anywhere and anytime. You can catch up on the news or your favorite programs. You can also have access to many PBS and Maine Public Television programs. The Maine Public app is available for Apple and Android smartphones and tablets. You can download it for free from both the Apple App Store and the Google Play Store.
Welcome back. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You're listening to Maine Calling. Today on the program, how to have difficult conversations about race and racial injustice. Joining me today, Shay Stewart Booley, the person behind the blog Black Girl in Maine. She is also executive director of Community Change Incorporated. And Debbie Irving is a racial justice educator and author of Waking Up White. Join our conversation. Give us a call, 1-800-399-3566, 1-800-399-3566. We'll go to David, who's calling from Cape Elizabeth. Hi, David. Go ahead.
Hey, good afternoon. I'm a white man. You're born and raised in Maine. My wife is black, and we have two children. And I've often wondered, you know, should I approach this conversation of racism, with my kids? How, when, why? It's kind of been a question that's perplexed me. I remember last summer there was a story out in New Hampshire where there was a biracial child who was assaulted in a playground by two white kids, and it just made me cry because that could have been one of my boys. I'd just like to see how your panelists respond to that question.
This is Shay. David, thank you for sharing that story. I'm going to answer your question because I'm a black woman who was married to a white man for a number of years, and I have two biracial children. I have an almost 26-year-old son and a 12-year-old daughter. I don't know the ages of your children, but I will tell you that your children, unless they have what's called a passing privilege where they literally look white, most likely will be identified regardless of how you view them. They at some point will probably be viewed as black if their mother is black. And I think you have to talk to them about race. I can tell you that part of my, you know, unofficial part of my journey was marrying a white guy from California who had no idea about race, and us having our first racialized experience as a married couple in probably 1988 in Chicago, where I share this story often, and I'll share it here, where we were pulled over, just a random pullover check in Chicago, and the police officer actually thought I was a sex worker and not his wife. And that was really a defining moment in our marriage, where my now ex-husband realized I have to learn about race. Like, I can't not know this. And to understand, you know, when we were told, oh, you're fine, you can go. And I immediately said, they pulled you over because I was in the passenger seat. And he goes, well, I don't understand why they would do that. So the point of this is that, yes, you need to talk to your children. I think even more so living in a predominantly white state, you have to talk to your children about race. If you have not read Debbie's book yourself, I would tell you to read Debbie's book. I obviously write a lot about race on the blog. I have since 2008. And I would encourage you and your wife to create a dialogue where you're both very comfortable talking about race with your kids, because you're right. That could be your that little boy, the situation that happened in New Hampshire last year, that could be one of your children. And it pains me to say that, but that's been my own lived experience, especially living in Maine since 2002.
And I would offer up as a resource Safety Pin Box, which has a curriculum to use in families. It's Safety Pin Box, SPB Kids. And I bought it and looked through it. I think it looks fabulous. It's a multi-week long, sort of once a week, let's do this project as a family to help you all explore your different racial identities. Because you've got three different racial identities in your one household, and it would be a really rich and, my guess is, rewarding project for you to do together.
David, thanks for your call. We're going to go to Robert. I think the media pushes Trump being a racist. How do you explain before Trump ran for president that Jesse Jackson gave Trump a Lifetime Achievement Award for being a champion of black causes? Trump's comment about Norway and Haiti was about the economic climate of each country, and I think it's racist for people to assume and somehow connect the dots that it was about race.
Well, first off, it's always fascinating to me when people name one black person and they use that person as an example, as the spokesman for a group of people. Fascinating that white people never have a spokesman, but in this case, Jesse Jackson would happen to be the spokesman for black people. He can think or feel whatever he wants to about Donald Trump. Donald Trump actually, beyond his current moment as president of the United States, has a track record going back to the 70s, I believe, of engaging in blatantly racist policies in terms of the real estate, who he chose to rent to, who he chose not to rent to in New York. Most certainly the situation around the Central Park Five, I believe it was. At one point, he took out a full page ad stating that these young men should be, you know, killed or put in prison for life, whatever the situation was. Even when it was proven that these young men were not guilty, he never recanted or took back those statements. And when you look at his business practices, there's a clear line of racist behavior that runs through it. I think that it's incredibly naive to ignore the fact that he named three countries. He named Haiti, he named El Salvador, I believe, and he mentioned African countries. We can't divorce that from the fact that all three of those locales are places with predominantly black and brown people, and that for him to pick one of the whitest countries on the planet as being a place that he would like to see people come to this country from, I think, honestly, we're going to just have to agree to disagree here, that you can't divorce race from that language that he's using in those actions.
Yeah, the Trump family as a whole has a long history. So Donald Trump's father was also a blatant racist, with all kinds of litigation around that. And Donald Trump is on record as saying he really believes in white genetic superiority. He his choice in wives and who he chooses to have children with is very much centered around that. So he really believes in quote-unquote good genes. And I think it is possible for those of us who pay attention to race, we know what that history is. But for people who don't, I'm sure it can feel like, but no, it's just this or it's just that. And so it has to do with the ability of people to not even know that we're living in a white supremacist organized nation, or that this individual or that individual has a strong attachment to it.
I was just going to add what you just said, Debbie, the piece around, we call it coded language, that so much of what Donald Trump says is actually in racially coded language, that if you're not aware of it, you don't see it. It's often in what he says when he vilifies certain groups of people, mm-hmm. that he's speaking when what we call a dog whistle politic. But if you're not aware of it because you've never had to be aware of it, you might think, why is the media pulling up all this stuff about him? Geez, the guy's just being who he is. No, you need to look a little bit deeper. And that's one of the reasons why we have to have these discussions, so that people can really start to go, I never really thought about racially coded language and what it means. Because we, again, I think at the top of this conversation, started off saying most people think of racism as the really blatant, open stuff. It's the white sheet. It's the cross. It's the racial slurs. Not realizing that's just one layer and one level of how racism plays out in our current world.
Kate sends an email. Would you please tell your guests about an event that's taking at the Jetport, a hashtag take a knee in prayer. We're gathered to recognize the message of NFL players who are calling for an end of racial injustice and systematic oppression. Clergy and lay people of all faiths will be kneeling to demonstrate our fervent prayer that our Black brothers and sisters will be treated with justice and kindness. This is Saturday, February 3rd from 4:30 to 5:30, the day before the Super Bowl, at the Portland Jetport baggage claim area. Did you guys know about this event? And I'm interested what you think about something like this.
I did. I believe someone affiliated with organizing that event did email me, and I haven't had a chance to respond. I think it's interesting. I don't know if I'll be able to participate. To be really fair, that's my son's birthday that day, so I may not be available. I do like to see this sort of thing happening, though. In terms of an impact, I don't expect that it would have a huge impact, but I also think it's important in a predominantly white state. I want to see white people actually getting involved and doing something that's active, and that's a place to start.
Every once in a while, I hear something from my pre-awakened brain. And when I think before I started waking up white, but meaning becoming racially conscious and learning the real history that's gone down in this country, I would have heard the term systematic oppression and a protest around that. And I would have thought, these are just ne'er-do-wells, that have too much time on their hands to go out and protest. Systematic oppression? This is the United States of America. This is the most free, democratic place in the world. Who are these rabble-rousers? And I just wonder if there are any listeners out there who hear in their heads the language I just said. And if you are still in that place, I would really encourage you to question the degree to which you might be stuck in what I call a white paradigm. And there is a lot of information that I know. I've never seen anyone get the information and go back to feeling stuck in a white bubble. It's very possible to be in the white bubble and not have the information come to you. You have to go to it.
I'll go to Arthur, who's calling from Peaks Island. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead.
Hi. I don't want to call up and say I'm a racist, but the unfortunate truth is that there's an awful lot of racism that I grew up with and that's embedded in me. I grew up in New York City, but in an all-white housing project. And so I learned a lesson that was never told to me, but I learned it by experience, that Blacks are tradespeople, maintenance people, nannies, perhaps nurses, and whites are the professionals. And so even to this day, I will sometimes see a person of color, and a voice in me says, what's he or she doing here?
Mm. Hi, Arthur. I know who you are, actually. I don't know if you know who I am, but I have seen you before. And I would say it's interesting when you have that moment when you find yourself going, what is this person doing here? I'd be curious to know what happens next. Just because it's good that you are, you have that question, but more importantly, you need to actually question why you have that question even now, if that makes any sense.
Go ahead, Arthur. I'm sorry, you were potted down.
Very quickly, another voice in me says, silly Arthur, they belong here. And it's clear to me that the first voice is the voice of the racism that surrounded me, that I grew up with. And the second voice is the voice of my moral compass that says, of course, they do belong here, and that I outwardly treat people of color with respect. And I don't think of them mostly as people of color, but people with a certain interest or connection to me. But I'm quite confident that that's not his. That most people of color see that in me and know exactly what's going on. And I don't know why so many white people are afraid to say that we're carrying the racism that is so malignant in our society.
Well, Debbie, you're nodding away over there.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm just so relating to this because I also, these deep-seated ideas are always voicing themselves to me. And like you, Arthur, I am able to override them and say, you know, that's old thinking. That is not based in truth. Thanks very much, but bye-bye. So I think the reason that people aren't able to do that is because they feel like there's something wrong with them, like they have a character flaw, when in fact, this was done to us. Whiteness, white ignorance was done to us. And so the way to undo it is to start undoing it in ourselves, for sure.
I just wanted to add to that, that one of the things around these conversations that people, especially well-meaning, well-intentioned white people, they come to the table, they come to the discussion, and they're thinking about how can I help people of color? You know, my God, you guys have been dealt a bad, you know, bad card in life. And I think Debbie's words, what she just said, is one of the biggest reasons why white people have to do this work, because I know there's a common misperception, especially in the state of Maine, that it's a predominantly white space. So, like, we couldn't have any issues with race here. I mean, my God, we're all white, so what's the problem? And in fact, that white ignorance is so deeply embedded in the culture, and that alone is why white people should strive to create what I call an anti-racism lens in which they can operate and view the world.
We're running short on time. I've been debating whether to take another call. I don't think we have time for that. So I want to, in the next just minute or so, ask each of you if you could say one thing to the people listening today, to our audience, Maine Calling audience, maybe a question to ask themselves, a conversation to have a friend. What would it be, Debbie?
I would say to white people, you deserve to know. You've been robbed of a full education, and you have been asked to compromise parts of your own humanity, actually, to buy into the system of whiteness that tells us that we should be afraid of people of color, or that we should be trusting people that maybe we shouldn't be trusting. So I really encourage people to take the bold step of self-educating. And certainly in terms of building cross-racial friendships, it's harder in a place like Maine, but there's no reason you can't start liking Facebook pages of Black Girl in Maine, for sure, and all kinds of other people from different perspectives around the country, and just start broadening your lens. It is a much more invigorating, energizing, exciting way to live a life, in my opinion.
Shay, quickly.
Get out of your racial silo. I repeat, leave your white racialized silo and save yourself, because I really don't want you to save me. I want you to save yourself, thus creating a better world for all of us.
Thank you both. That was Shay Stewart Booley, Executive Director of Community Change Incorporated and the creator of the blog Black Girl in Maine. Debbie Irving, the author of Waking Up White, a racial justice educator and writer. Roddy Nickpour ran the board today. Maine Calling is produced by Jonathan Smith and by Cindy Hahn. Tomorrow on the program, addressing obesity in Maine. I'm Jennifer Rooks. You've been listening to Maine Calling on Maine Public Radio.